No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock. We give the people the right to vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony, along with my amazing co-host, the ambulatory Maria Sanchez. We hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion. Be part of the conversation. Call in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO and the number one. Maria,
yes,
how
sir.
Are you? It's so nice to have you back. I know you've been back for a week, but
yeah.
It seems like we were both out for a long time. So it's great to have you back.
It's great to be with you as always, Michael. Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm at not my home, but a friend's home recovering. And I had 4 home health visits this week between the home nurse and 2 PTs and 1 OT. And I've got the same next week. And then they say that I can go back to my place probably next weekend. So right. I'm looking forward to getting back to some kind of normal because I've been out of my place since June 20. June 20th.
And that's tough. It's tough to be away from home.
Yeah,
even if
absolutely.
Somebody that's really great to you that cares about you and
exactly. But yeah, everybody's just astonished at my progress. And of course, I don't have anything to compare it with. And they all keep saying, we rarely see bilateral. We usually only have one person do one hip at a time. So you're kind of new for us. And I'm like, I didn't have a choice. They were both terrible. So here we go, you know.
Well, and bravo to you for having the courage to do it, because I'm sure it was the right thing to do. And it's true. I mean, I've known plenty of people that have had a single hip replaced, but I've only known one other person that had both of them replaced. And he was very young, actually. He was about 40 years old when that happened to him. Yeah, and he was on the verge of being a pro tennis player. So he had just worked so hard and had kind of a congenital defect as well. And so, but he's the only other person and that I've ever known, and he was 40 at the time. So,
wow, that's tough.
It
really
is tough.
But I have to tell you, the recovery post-op is easier for us younger folks because, like, I still have my muscle strength. I have my core strength. So I'm able to get in and out of bed just using my abdomen, whereas other people have to have devices and assistance and lifting with their hands and all of that stuff. And I just kind of roll in and out. So that's the good news about being younger and having the procedure.
Well, and you know what? That's something that really amazed me in that I was in a cast for like 6 months. So I stopped walking. Every day I walked a dog a couple of miles a day, and I stopped walking. And then when I started again a few weeks ago, when the cast came up, I was just amazed at how my muscles had atrophied over that period of time. Yeah.
Wow.
Because, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, when you're 30 years old, you don't do anything for a couple of months. It's no big deal.
Right.
You know, now, I'm like, I'm still not up to walking the dog as far as I was walking him before I had the cast on. So it takes a while to get it. Yeah, it's just amazing.
Yeah, because I was doing 3 miles a day, 7 days a week prior to. So I'll be curious to see. And I'm not going to be nowhere near that for, I'm sure. I think they said I have to watch the hip precautions for at least 3 months.
Yeah,
6 months is good, but a full year is the best.
Well, and that's the nice thing about my foot thing. Once it heals, you know.
Yay. And you were a quiet sufferer, I might add. You didn't let us know any of that.
Oh, my God. I hope my family is listening to this because they said all I did was whine. About it, like, oh,
yeah,
go on,
you know. You're so, well, and speaking about being quiet, and for our listeners, I asked the senator permission because I would never want to pop something like this on someone if they were unwilling. But you have lived this fascinating life, and we don't know a lot about you personally. We know about you politically, we know about your civics and all of that, a little bit about your children, but I was curious and you agreed, so I'm just going to ask you, how did you meet your wife?
Well, you know, I wish I had something really clever to say, like, you know, we met in prison or something, but but the truth of the matter is that, you know, I have a dear friend, her name is Sue. I saw her last night. And she was my wife's college roommate. And now this is my take on the situation, you know, on what happened. You'd have to ask Mrs. Brown to get a really, really comprehensive, you know, and unbiased explanation. But my feeling is that I started my own business and I started to make some money. And this annoyed Sue that I was single. And I think she said to herself, look, he could be spending this money on one of my friends. What's he doing out there just running around doing nothing? And so she had her college roommate, a woman named Pat, that she wanted me to meet. And Sue was relentless in her pursuit of getting me and Pat together. She used to, you know, every time I would see her, she would say something to me about it. And, she and her husband lived with my best friend, Pete. So I'd go over to see Pete and she'd just be all over me. Did you call my friend Pat? What's wrong? What's wrong? What's he going to do to you? Is he going to kidnap you? Why don't be such a big scary cat?
So call were you reluctant?
Yes, I was very reluctant. And the reason I was reluctant is because I was in my 30s at the time and I had a lot of friends that it set me up on blind dates and none of them went well. I mean, I wanted to sit down with these people the morning after the date and say, what were you thinking that I would have something in common with this person? So I was very skeptical about it, especially because I knew that Pat and Sue were very close friends. And I thought, well, that's always fraught with danger. You know, if you go out and you don't like them, right. You know, and so, anyway, I would say to Sue, I would say, why don't you have a party and invite us both to the party? And then we'll meet each other. It is casual. There'll be no pressure, you know? Mm-hmm. And unbeknownst to me, she was doing the same thing to Pat. She was calling Pat and saying, just have a glass of wine and call him on the phone. Go ahead, do it. You know, and Pat never would do it. So finally, I called Pat and, we went out on a blind date, and after the blind date, my friend Pete called and said he knew Pat. And he said, what do you think? What did you think? And I said, I thought she was really nice, but she's not my type. Oh. And then Pete said to me, well, maybe that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I reflected on the fact that my previous girlfriend had stalked me for over a year. So I thought, yeah, maybe I should be switching types, huh? And I went out with her again, and finally, you know, I fell in love with Pat because she was the best person I had ever met. I never met a person that cared more about the kind of person they were than Pat. She, you know, I live in a city in Washington, D.C. I live in an environment where everybody wants to tell you who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, that's 10 minutes into a conversation, you get people's resumes. And I know you live in L.A. I know it's a similar thing. Pat was one of the first people that I ever had a relationship with who cared more about what she was rather than who she was. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
she cared about that she was a good sister and a good daughter and a good friend. And, you know, and that she was loyal and trustworthy and honest and, you know, all these things. And I thought, you know, this is the kind of person that I want to build a life with. And this is the kind of person that I want to settle down and have children with. And I was right. I have three of the most wonderful children. They just, not one of them has ever done anything in their lives that I'm not proud of. And that, more than anything, is a testimony to Pat. You know, I've been smart enough to stay the hell out of her way and pay the bills. But, you know, she really has raised three great children who come from a seriously deficient gene pool, because all three of them are just like me. You know, Pat's just is this honest, great person, and they're all like me. They're high maintenance, they're whiny, they're, you know, but they're all great people. They're all doing great things. My son just graduated from college. I have another daughter who graduated with honors, who lives in Chicago, and the third one is in her second year of college, and they're all doing great. And again, that's all a testimony to her and to Sue's relentless pursuit of, you know, we kid Sue, we say that at my funeral, she'll be leaning over and saying in Pat's ear, just come out to the car and meet him. You don't have to, you know, cause she's always trying to fix people up. But in this case, I owe Sue a great debt of gratitude.
Did that, first of all, your story brought tears to my eyes on several occasions, because it's amazing and remarkable, the wonderful things you say about your wife. But did your relationship unfold over time, or was it, you were like, I'm 30-something, I already know what I've had, and I know what I have, and I'm not getting any younger, so let's
get on with
this? Yeah,
it was pretty quick. I mean, okay. Pat and I probably went out for 2 years before we got married, but we got engaged after about a year.
Okay. Because there's both sides of the coin with that. Is I always like to quote the Bush 43. They met on a blind date and got married 3 months later.
Yeah.
And she has her master's degree in library science.
Yeah, I know. I know. And, you know, believe me, I know every famous librarian in the world.
I bet you do.
It's a strange little group, the librarians. But they're all pretty honest people. And they go into I think, becoming librarians because they really want to help people. And that's what librarians do, you know?
Yeah.
They help you find your way when you're lost. But, I had a very good sense of you know, who, what I wanted. And I wanted to have kids. I thought that was really important. And I wanted to be involved with somebody who also wanted kids and who, you know, and Pat and I were headed in the same direction. It's funny because, you know, politically we weren't very much in sync. We're still not in a lot of ways.
But, well, because it's her father that's the staunch Republican, right?
Yeah, a lot of people in her family are staunch Republicans. And I wouldn't say that Pat's a Republican, but, you know, we differ on some very basic issues. One of the first big fights that we ever had, this is a true story, was over the fact that I was watching TV and I saw them on the floor of Congress debating whether they should pass an amendment that makes it illegal, an amendment to the Constitution, making it illegal to burn the American flag. And I said, oh, how stupid is this? That's what's great about America. What's great about America is that you can burn the flag, you know, if you want to. And that didn't sit right with Mrs. Brown. He's like, you want to burn the flag? Yeah, go over to the Soviet Union, burn the flag. See what they do to you over there. You know, so, and you know, and that's another, I love the fact that she's patriotic. We have a difference of opinion. We don't speak about politics a whole lot, the two of us, but, and as a rule, she doesn't like it. She doesn't like the falseness and the, you know, the way.
Backstabbing.
Yeah, they are. They're backstabbing, you know. And I always say to her, this is the analogy I always use. I say, look, if you don't want to get an elbow thrown at you, don't play in the NBA, you know, because that's the way the game's played. Sure, right. It's not right. It's not right to throw a 90-mile-an-hour fastball on the inside corner and to scare the batter. Maybe that's not the fair thing to do, but that's the way they do it in the pros. If you're scared of 90-mile-an-hour fastballs on the inside corner, don't play the game. So, you know, so I get kicked around a lot, but, you know, I feel like that's part of what I bargained for when I
So tell me this then. You have a successful marriage, and what do you attribute that to, aside from happy wife, happy life?
Well, I just learned as I got older, you know, I learned that the two most important words in a marriage are yes, dear, and, you know, whatever you want. I mean, you know, you got to pick your battles, just like kids. You got to pick your battles, and you've got to, you know, and you've got to be headed in the same direction. I think that's really important. You know, I think that if one of you wants children and the other wants a career and you can't work it out, it's not going to work for you. Right. I think you've got to both want them, and we both wanted healthy, successful kids, and we've had that, and, you know, and we both supported each other in whatever we do, and I think that's another important thing. We don't, you know, Pat has never said to me, get out of this stupid thing you do, even though I know that's what she thinks about it. I know that she thinks that it's bad, it's not healthy, you know, these people are mean to me, she doesn't get it. You know, and I've always been the same way with her. I've always supported everything she did. Pat was a stay-at-home mom for several years, mm-hmm. and she started to volunteer at the library. And she said, well, I kind of like it, but I don't know if, you know, if I can work at the library. And I pushed her on it. I said, you know, see if they need somebody, blah, 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 blah. And she did. She looked into it. They needed her. She got a scholarship to go back to college, like you. She went back and got a master's degree. She got her master's degree in library science. But I've always supported her, and she's always supported me. I really, you know, I don't understand librarians. I wouldn't want to be a librarian, but, you know, but I support what she does in it, and it makes her happy, and she's good at it. You know, and I think that's really the important thing. You know, I say this with kids all the time. I used to think that if you brought children up in a Skinner box next to each other, they turn out exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I then had children and realized what a stupid idea that was, that they come hardwired with right. a bunch of preloaded software. And the real trick, I think, in being a parent is to try to figure out what that is that they're good at, that they love, that their passion is, and try to figure out ways to encourage that in them and make them flourish. You know, I think we won't worry too much about what school our kid goes to or what, you know, or what they accomplish in life materially and otherwise, rather than saying, well, we really should be happy. What we really should be concerned about is, are they happy? Are they happy with their lives, and are they doing productive things? Because I know a lot of Ivy League graduates who are unhappy.
Well, and you've hit the nail on the head, I think, for all of us, too, is that if you do what you love and you're happy, what better statement is that to having a life?
Right.
I mean, I That's right. And, you know, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life because you're following your passions. But I like you with I did that with my children with the Catholicism, too, because I had them get all of their sacraments. I even sent them to Catholic school. And I said, but ultimately, it's between you and your happiness and your picture and vision of God, if there is one. And consequently, all four children do not practice or identify with Catholicism. But I did my job. Because I started them with the baptism, they got confirmed, and then when they're 18, it's their life and right. their choices. And would I wish it different? You betcha. But if they're happy, that's all I care about.
Right. Well, you're a better person than I am, because I intervene all the time. I tell
you?
I was your youth group leader at church. And when they call themselves atheists or, you know, or say, oh, I don't believe, then I get all over them.
Yeah, mine call themselves, quote, apathetic agnostics.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't have an axe to grind. There may or may not be.
You know, and I had an axe to grind with the Catholic Church. Both my parents died when I was 15, and I was somebody that felt that God had somehow, you know, chosen me to pick on.
Right.
You know, I was mad at God.
And how could you not be, Michael?
I was mad at the church, and
I was. Of course.
You know, and but. When, as I got older, I started to feel that God speaks to all of us, and a real challenge for us is to figure out how to listen to the things he's saying. Mm-hmm. You know, I have this happen to me all the time. I can't tell you the times that God has intervened in my life. But you've got to be open to it. You've got to be able to hear what's going on to understand. And I don't even know that you fully understand it, but to try and understand the things that he says to all of us.
Well, and I always say, too, along those lines, just get out of your own way so that you can let it be God's way. And whether somebody believes in a God or not, you know, or a higher power or Mother Nature or what have you, I think it's all the same. We distract ourselves with so much to do and technology and chatter that it's all that white noise stops the message that the universe is trying to unfold for us, and we just are too busy.
Well, and you know, you get so wrapped up in yourself that you can't see the bigger picture. You know, I'll tell you a story. One of the many times that I feel that God spoke to me, I was standing in front of a polling place. This is the first time I'd ever run. Now, I didn't have any money for polling. I didn't have any money. I had no idea. I had no idea whether I was going to get 10 votes or whether I was going to get 1,000,000 votes.
You're kidding. No idea.
No. So I'm standing in front of a popular polling place. I look, you know, I go to the Board of Elections. I find out what polling place in Washington, there's 142 of them, which one has the most voters. I find out who it is, and I go to that polling place, and I spend the afternoon giving out literature, excuse me, and there's some people that come by, and you know, like you say, politics is a tough business, and I think to myself, what am I doing here? You know, I mean, I didn't have a lot of money. I didn't. You know, I ran as good a campaign as I could run, but it was mostly money out of my own pocket. I didn't raise a nickel. I did crazy things like I put signs all over Washington, D.C., but I didn't have the money to get good signs. So I put like cardboard signs and it rained for 3 days and they all fell down.
Oh, Michael.
And so I had to put up 2,000 new signs in like a couple of days. It almost killed me and my wife and other people that helped me. And there I was, and I was just feeling so damn sorry for myself. And I said, this is stupid. It's not going to end up well for me. At that moment, right walking down the street was a woman with an oxygen tank. She wasn't very old. She's probably in her 50s. But she had, you know, the hose in her nose and the oxygen tank. And she was very frail, and she moved by me. And I didn't give her any literature or talk to her. I was like, I just want to leave her alone. She didn't look like she was doing very well. And when she came out of the polling place, she stopped in front of me, and she looked at me, and she said, I voted for you. And she moved on. And at that moment, I just thought to myself, I felt so, so bad all of a sudden. I thought to myself, you know what? If that's the only vote I get, then the effort was worth it. That this woman would take the time to take an interest in me with all that's
obvious. She has going on, right.
And you know, I really think at times like that, you know, that God sends you a message. You're on the right track. You're doing the right thing. And that night, I found out that I won 142 out of 142 precincts. I didn't lose one precinct. And, you know, and that's what started me. The next day, the papers exploded with nobody knew who this guy was.
Exactly.
How did this happen? Yeah. You know, I ran against a guy that was very popular. Or I shouldn't say popular. I should say, or if he was popular, he would have won. I should have said very well known.
Well known.
He was one of the most well known people that was running that year. And I even won in his precinct, 142 out of 142. So,
my goodness.
You know, I really think that you know,
that's a story.
And you carefully. Yeah, you carefully listen. Oh, yeah, and it's happened to me over and over and over again, especially in politics. It's, you know, I can't
How
tell
so?
You.
I mean, God poke is what I call them, usually doesn't happen very often.
Well, you know, I'll tell you another great story. And that is that I get a call from the DNC one day. And you'd have to really know the people at the DNC to fully appreciate this. But some woman, an old friend of mine says, "Hey, man, don't you know a lot about Indians?" And I go, "No, I don't know a lot about Indians."
Did she mean Native Americans?
Yeah. And okay. She said, "Don't you have a lot of Native American clients?" And I say, "No, I don't have any clients that are Native American." She says, "Oh, well, don't you have a lot of friends that are?" I said, "No, not really. Grew up with a kid, but you know, a good friend of mine who's Cherokee, but other than that." She said, "Well, didn't you tell me a story about Indians one time?" And I said, "Yeah, my sister was an oil and gas lawyer that represented many Native American tribes. And when I was a teenager, I went across the country and I stayed on a bunch of reservations." You know, this was 40 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And she says to me, "You're perfect." And I always joke. And I said, if I had said no to that, she would have said, "Don't you have a buffalo nickel?"
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
They were just grabbing it. You know, they would have taken anybody, you know.
What were they looking for?
They're looking for people to go out on the reservation and campaign for John Kerry. Now, this is the thing about Native Americans. They vote very often. They usually vote Democratic in a national campaign.
I would imagine.
But they don't vote a lot. You know, they have very, very low voter turnout.
Okay.
They have their own governments usually, and they have tribal elections, which are supposed to be. People say you think politics in Washington is tough. You should come to a tribal election, but anyway, they were looking for people to go out on reservations and help organize. And they're saying, look, if we can get them out to vote, they'll probably vote Democratic. So what we really want to do is we want to just do a get out the vote effort. It's not even, you don't have to go out there and persuade anybody or anything. Just figure out, we're going to put together, and they put together this incredible team. Some of the people that I worked with had worked for John F. Kennedy on his election when they were teenagers. Yeah, just an incredible team. But I get out there.
Where's that?
And, Bemidji, Minnesota.
Okay.
And Bemidji, Minnesota is in the center of three of the largest Indian reservations in the United States.
Wow.
White Earth, Red Lake, I forget what the third one's called, but there's all these reservations, and they're reservations of the Ojibwa Indians. So I get out there and I work. And
so are you basically arranging transportation to the polling?
Yeah, and getting out and telling, you know, handing out literature and telling everybody how important it is for them to come vote and making sure they get transportation, and then poll watching to make mm-hmm. sure that things are going okay and that there isn't any interference, which there was at one reservation. One guy was arrested. But, you know, trying to and arranging hiring people to go get out the vote. And we paid people, you know, we pay campaign workers, you know, like, I forget what they paid them, $10 an hour or something. And we pay them right away. And we had to do a lot of interesting things. We were paying poll workers, for example, and we found out that they were cashing their checks at the local grocery store, and the local grocery store guy was charging them 10% to cash their checks. And we're not allowed to pay them in cash. It's a violation of federal law to pay people in cash, right? So right. We went into the grocery store and we said, look, we're buying groceries for our campaign workers. They're patrons of your store anyway. They live here. And if you don't knock this off, we're going to set up a bank. We're going to call to Washington and get cash. And we're going to cash the checks because the rule is that you have to have a check. You have to have an audit trail. But we could have issued you a check and then cashed the check and
right.
keep the check as a record. And we said, you know what? And when we do, we're going to give them a gift certificate to the grocery store down the street so that they can go buy their groceries there. And the guy stopped it. right there. So we did a lot of things like that. I got a call on election day, for example, and they said, somebody said to me, look, they've arrested the guy that's driving our car, and we can't get everybody to the polls. So could you talk to the state police and see if you can straighten this out? And I get on, I figure he's got an overdue traffic fine or something. I get on the phone with the state police officer, mm-hmm. and I'm pleading my case when he says to me, we've arrested this guy on suspicion of armed robbery.
Oh, dear.
And we have a warrant out for him. So I get back on the phone and I go, look, man, you can't. They're not going to let the guy go. Right. They're not going to let the guy go and then say he promises to come back after the election. No. He's armed robbery. You get arrested for it.
Yeah.
And you should get arrested for it. Yes. Right. So it was very interesting. But the point of telling you all this is that I was raised by my older sister, who was just the most amazing person. And she died just prior to me getting married to Pat, actually. She died of breast cancer, like my mother did when she was in her early 40s. And I went out to Bemidji. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know why I was there. And on the first day, the Indians that I worked with were people that knew my sister. Now, my sister had been gone for 20 years.
No way.
They found, through a few conversations with one of the women that was leading the group, a woman that I later worked with, she said, she figured out that I was Pat's brother, and she handed me the phone. She said, here, somebody wants to talk to you. And she handed me the phone, and the woman who had been my sister's Oklahoma lawyer, my sister was a Washington lawyer, but her counterpart, a woman that I knew very well, that I hadn't spoken with in more than 20 years at my sister's funeral, got on the phone and started talking to me. And I've been in touch with those people ever since. So,
oh my goodness.
Again, just.
What a story.
Yeah, and of all the places in the world, it's a big world, right? And,
yes, it is.
You know, my sister represented several Native American tribes, but. What are the chances that I would run into people that knew her and worked with her and set up a scholarship fund in her name?
And so as the DNC suggested, you were the perfect person for the what they needed,
I was, as it turned out, right? I was. And it was my dear friend Lori Box from Iowa that did that. And it's funny because Lori was the first person that I ever met in the Democratic Party. When I was in college, I sent her my resume, and she sent me one of those letters that, one of those, you are eminently qualified and we're so, happy that you would apply for a job with us, but unfortunately there's nothing available and we will keep your resume on file. One of those letters where you can actually see them throwing your resume into the trash as you're reading it.
You remembered that and her?
Well, I met her shortly thereafter.
Okay.
And we became good friends over the years. And I often would say to her, you were the first woman to ever reject me. And she would laugh and she would say, that couldn't possibly be true. So, we were very good friends.
So, as a segue, you were politically inclined as a younger man, meaning an adolescent, it sounds like, even. So the grassroots has been in your blood, and I'm curious how folks who might be listening, because obviously if they're listening to the program, they have an interest somehow in our system or in politics or in whatever it is that you and I may share. What advice would you give somebody who might think that it's the process is bigger than a person, or who am I that how could they get involved? I know I've always done it as a volunteer.
Right.
But is that where you start?
Yes. And that's certainly where I started. And that's the beauty of it, that anybody can do it. And, I reached a point at one point in my life where I had created this business, and the business was going well, but I didn't like what I did. And I said to a friend of mine, I'm thinking of giving up the business and getting back into politics. Because what happened was I started out in politics. Then I went to work in public interest for a while, which I didn't like. And I formed my own company, but I really wasn't involved in the campaigning and the other stuff. I was involved in other types of activities that politicians and public interest groups needed. I did direct mail. And my friend said to me, well, if you want to be involved in politics, be involved in politics. He goes, I don't understand what the hell you're saying, because you can do anything to make a living and still be involved in politics.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Right. You don't need to make your money at it. You can make your money doing something else, which many, many people do, right? You know that. Many people come from law and other areas. You know, certainly Donald Trump was not a politician.
Right.
You know, so you can aspire to the highest office in the land and without making it your career. And he was right. And that's what I did. And I always stayed involved. So
and that's the takeaway that I'd like our listeners to have is, if you care and if you're interested and you have a passion, you can start even by answering phone or stuffing envelopes or walking precincts or get out the vote. Or, I mean, there's so many ways that people can get involved, and it doesn't have to be full time. Give what you have.
And I can't tell you how rewarding it is.
Yes.
It's incredibly rewarding. You know, I went to I like to tell this story sometimes when I speak to groups. Last week, for example, I spoke in front of the oldest Boy Scout troop in America. Now, I was a Boy Scout, you know, so that may not feel good to everybody, but it sure as hell felt good to me.
I bet.
You know, and so I tell this story. I had to give a speech one time for the Obama people right after he got elected. And I went to the Navy Memorial in the District of Columbia. And I walk in, and there's an information desk. And I say to this guy, there's an old guy standing behind the information desk. And I say to him, hi, I'm Senator Brown. And I have to give a speech. Do you know where I'm supposed to be? And he said, well, I think you're probably supposed to be in the main auditorium, and you go down this hall and make a right and go down the staircase, whatever. So I go, and I give my little speech, and I do my little thing, and I'm walking out. And as I'm walking out, this guy calls out to me. He goes, Senator. And I go, yeah. And I go over to him, and he says, I want to show you something. And he takes down a picture that he set up on a shelf behind me, and it's a picture of a cargo ship. And on the deck, there's about 15 guys standing around in t-shirts and bell bottoms. And he said, this was my ship during the Second World War. I served on it in the Pacific throughout the whole war. And he said, and these were my shipmates. And I said, oh, well, that's great. Thank you for your service, blah, blah, blah. And he told me a story about each member on the ship. He said, this was Billy, and he played baseball, and he did this and that. And this was Joe, and he was my best friend, and we shared a bunk. Then when he got to the end, he said, of all those 15 men, he said, I took the picture. I'm not in the picture, but all 15 of them died during the Second World War. Every single one of them was a casualty of the Second World War.
Oh, wow.
And we talked for a few minutes, and then I left. And, you know, and the thing that struck me about the whole thing was how honored I was that this guy would take time to share something so personal with me, something that was so important to him. And he thought, because I was an elected official, that I should know about it, and I should know about his buddies who he had been carrying a torch for 50 years. And, you know, there's a lot of moments like that in politics. There's a lot of times when people reach out to you, and I can't tell you, for me, there's not a better feeling. It's, you know.
Well, you are. To the man or born, because I'm just thinking about, I got a wife and kids that I need to be home with, and I don't know these people, and I don't really care, and why are you taking my time, but I'm going to sit here and be polite. And you're touched by it.
Oh my God, yeah. And so many things, you know, that people, they come up to you. I mean, there are nasty people. There are people that say terrible things to you. But there's so many good people out there. You're so, it's such a way to touch people's lives as opposed to being anonymous somewhere and, you know, making part of a widget and never getting to see the whole picture. Politics allows you to see the whole picture. It allows you to make change. It allows you to fight for things that are worth fighting for. You know, some of the things, look, fighting for a parking space at the mall really isn't worth it. Right. You know, just give it up and move on to another space, whether right. it was your, you know, whether you were there first or not.
Whether you had the blinker on or not.
Right. Whether you had the blinker on or not. But fighting for people's rights or fighting to change a law that would benefit people or standing up for people that can't stand up for themselves. It's a wonderful thing to do. It'll make a, you know, Martin Luther King said it best. He said, you know, involve yourself in the struggle for social justice because you will make a better country out of your country. You'll make a better world to live in, and you'll be a better person for the experience. And all that is true. If you stand up for somebody else, you will be a better person for the experience. Your country will be a better place to live in. And that's what scares me. You know, let's make a segue. I've loved walking down memory lane with you, but
me too. I have more questions, but yes, we may segue.
Yeah, let's segue into them because this is what scares me right now, Maria, is that we're so far apart. We're so far apart between the two sides. And I just came today from a rally that the Democratic Party threw here in town. Was like a picnic. The firemen came out and you know, God bless firemen, right? They're yes. always out there doing something for the community in their spare time, like they don't do enough.
Right.
But they were out there cooking hot dogs and hamburgers for everybody.
Aww.
And it was entitled Resist. Resist. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to resist. Well, I don't get it. Where is working together to make this a better country? We're not going to get anywhere if one side pushes and the other side resists.
Mm-hmm.
We need to figure out a way to come together. And
I thought you were going to say that they're starting to poll and find out how they can be more relevant and relatable, because that's what needs to be done on both sides, frankly.
Yeah.
What is that anger that got Donald Trump elected, and how can we assuage that so that we can move forward?
Well, that's exactly the way, you know, I was saying, I don't know what the difference, I can't remember, you would know this, what the different stages of grief are, but yeah. we're still in the denial stage
yes.
in the Democratic Party. And we sit there and we lambast Trump for being fixated on the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to say that isn't true. But The Democrats are doing the same thing. They're fixated on it. Look, man, we lost the election. We lost it. So we need to find out a way to get back in power. Not to, if you want to blame it on the Russians, great. If you want to blame it on the Electoral College, fine. Change the system if that's right. really your grievance. Right. But it's over. And now it's time to figure out a way to work together to make America, not to make America great again, to make sure that America stays great. It's always been great.
Well, but here's the other thing, Michael, is resistance isn't policy. It's just a reaction.
Right.
And that's right. not going to get you anywhere either.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And which one of us, Maria, that have had teenage children, haven't seen them fight to the death over the last Oreo cookie or, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's not a mature thing to do, right? The mature thing is to accept it and move on. And that's what you'd say as a mother. That's what Pat would say to the kids. She would say to one of them, let the other one have the cookie. Next time you can have the cookie.
Nice.
Okay. You yeah. know, right. Let's resolve this. Don't put the cookie on the floor and stomp on it so that nobody can have it.
Exactly.
And that's what we're doing. We're stomping on the cookie.
So what was today's event? Was it sponsored by
the DNC? Local Democrat? No, the local Democratic Party.
Okay.
The DNC didn't show up. They were invited, but they didn't come.
Which is probably a good thing, don't you think?
Yeah, probably good. Probably they understood this, that, you know, let these people grouse, let them get it out of the system. But you know what?
It seems to only fan the flames, though. It doesn't seem to be petering out.
Well, and, you know, they talk about the fact that Donald Trump, through his tweets and other things, are always changing the narrative so that we never get down to the meat of the subject. But you know what? It's what we all do, because they asked me to get up there and speak. And I said, you want to do something to get to move your agenda forward? Elect two United States senators and a United States representative to have a vote.
Yeah.
Now, we'll all come out. They ran a poll last week that shows that one in three Washingtonians has been involved in a protest against Trump since January.
Wow.
That's 225,000 people
in
Washington have been involved in a protest against Trump. In the 11 years that I've been here, we haven't had 10,000 people in 11 years show up to stand up for the right to vote. So, you know, they talk about the opposition distracting them. The opposition doesn't need to be distracted. They're already distracted.
Yeah.
You know,
gosh, Michael, are you getting people to listen to you? Because you make such great sense.
Well, I don't know how much they listen to me. You know, people work against me inside the government because they don't want us to have any real credibility. We're competition. This is a really hard thing, I think, for most people to understand, is that there's this competition that you don't necessarily have in a business. You know, yes, if you're in the sales department, you want to be the top salesman. But that usually focuses on you doing the best job you can, not you trying to undercut the other salespeople so that you make sure you do. Well, in politics, it's just, you know, the people are always trying to undercut you. This is one thing that I think Donald Trump doesn't understand, which is hard for him, because he's always run a business and he's been the big boss. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't understand that there are all sorts of multiple power bases inside the democratic process, so that when he's dealing with somebody like James Comey doesn't answer to him. James Comey answers to a lot of people. You know, he has other constituency. Mm-hmm. Or when he's dealing with McCain's got to go back to Arizona and sell that health bill. So it's not just about saying, okay, Mr. President, whatever you want. Sometimes it's hard for me because the people that are supposed to be supporting me and standing behind me actually work against me because they see me as competition.
I can see that. And that's got to be troubling and terrible for you.
Well, it's troubling. Yeah. But again, it's the life we've chosen. And, you know, and I think you just have to say when you take a job like this, is it worth being, you know, the Don Quixote of politics? If
you go
charging at windmills and you never get anything accomplished, is your effort diminished by the fact that you stood up and you did the right thing? I don't think it is. I think that if you stand up and do the right thing, that's what's important, you know, and that you can change the world, you know, if you do it right.
I can't believe that you're still this optimistic with being in the system as long as you've been in. It's actually inspirational to me because I'm a Pollyanna. I see the glasses half full, the rainbow ends and all that stuff. But I haven't been in the system that like you've been in. I mean, I've been kicked to the curb, don't get me wrong. But you see it on a day in and day out basis.
Well, you know what? Part of the thing with me is that I felt like I snuck in the back door. So I was lucky, you know. I dropped out of high school. I did a lot of things when I was young that weren't necessarily productive. Didn't hurt anybody. but acted out in a lot of ways. And then I got to the working for Jimmy Carter. I volunteered, and I started to see all these guys that went to Harvard and Yale and Brown, and they had trust funds. And some of the guys I worked with, you know, we're talking about the kids that I worked with. One is now the governor of Virginia. The other one's a United States senator from Virginia. One of them was the top aide to the president of the United States. And you know, or no, I'm sorry, the first lady, and a woman that would have been tried to be the president of the United States. I mean, and I always felt like I snuck in, like some one day they were going to notice me, and somebody's going to say, "Hey, what are you doing in here?" You know, so I still got that job. I'm still like sneaking in the back door, and you know, but I'm just thankful to have a seat
at the table.
I've watched this amazing thing unravel in front of me. I've had a front row seat to America in action, and I think that that's been a really positive thing. Now, we've gone to another week without discussing a lot of material issues. We're going to have to get back to them sooner or later, but it's been fun. And let me say that next week, right, we're going to have the lady on to talk about
aging.
Getting old.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
What that looks like, what the demographics are, what it means, what we can do, what we shouldn't do.
Now, I happen to be an expert on this because I'm old. I'm ancient. I went to Edinburgh, and I fit right in. I was sitting in an 1,100-year-old college thinking, I look like the rest of the architecture, little broken down and starting to wrinkle. Yeah, so tune in next week, all you old people, and find out what
you've
got in
store. And if you're not old, you're going to be if you're lucky. So it's relevant to everybody or your parents or what have you. Yeah, this is a topic that touches us all one way or the other.
Well, and as my dear old dad used to say, it's better to be lucky than good. And that really is the bottom line for me, Maria. This is where I'm going to leave it, is that I've been very lucky in my life. I've been lucky to have such a great partner as my wife. I've been lucky to have people that care about me and have a reason to get up every morning that I feel is important. And among the many lucky breaks I've gotten is to have a co-host like you. You really are. It's really true that you've changed the nature of the show, and you've made it a lot more professional. And I love doing this, and I especially love doing it with you. So thanks.
Thank you. And guess what? I don't consider anything that you mentioned luck. There is some good fortune involved there, but it all took effort and some difficult decisions.
Okay, Mrs. Brown, I hope you're listening to that. And we're going to leave you with now a classic song by Woody Guthrie.
Yes.
Because this land is your land, and it's my land, and we'll see you next week.
Have a fabulous week. Thank you.
Thank you.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. Give the people their right to vote.